Hello and welcome to the Immigration Roundup podcast for April 2023. My name is Colin Yeo. I am joined by Sonia Lenigan. Sonia, can you just quickly say hello?
Hi, everyone.
And this month we are going to be talking a bit more about the illegal migration bill and its potential consequences. We're going to be going over a four-part series by Professor David Cantor, which I thought was excellent. We're going to talk about the right way of tackling the asylum backlog. We're going to look at my suggestion of a new British Citizenship Act that I put on the website during April. We'll look at the resumption of hostile environment bank account closures. We've got a load of cases to run through, and we're going to end by talking about a few business immigration issues. But we think that we'll actually be relatively brief this month, although perhaps I shouldn't say that. Perhaps that's going to mean that we actually end up doing some sort of bumper episode. So that's the running order for this month. If you want to claim CPD, Continuing Professional Development, points for listening to the podcast, then head over to freemovement.org.uk/training and sign up as a member, and we offer a monthly quiz to show your regulator that you're keeping yourself up to date. So I'm due to kick off, and I'm starting with the four-part series that Professor David Cantor did on the illegal migration bill. So it's four parts to it. First one is, how does the illegal migration bill breach the Refugee Convention? Second one is, illegal migration bill helping force refugees into illegality and danger? Part three, could safe and legal routes stop the boats? And part four, if the legal migration bill is unworkable, what can the government do instead? And if you want a kind of primer to the legal and then also the practical issues that the illegal migration bill raises, then this is just a really good, well-written, well-argued introduction to the whole thing. So the section, the first part on the compatibility with the Refugee Convention, I think is excellent. David really clearly explains the background to the Refugee Convention, the history where the Refugee Convention came from, the compromises that the, as he says, hard-headed drafters of the convention made. And it's a good explanation of why it's in breach of the sort of spirit and intention of the Refugee Convention, and why that matters in international law, and why that is a breach of international law. So that's a really good start to the series. He then goes on to look at how the illegal migration bill is likely to make life worse for refugees, and essentially, it's not likely to stop people coming, but it will change the way that they come, and it's likely to force people onto much more dangerous routes and different modes of entry. So it's not likely to stop people, but it is likely to again, as previous changes to British borders have done, to sort of basically change routes of entry. The third part on whether safe and legal routes could actually stop the boats, in that kind of resonant phrase that even Rishi Sunak has used, I think is a really interesting and well-argued piece. It looks at some of the complexities around offering safe and legal routes, the issues of whether they might act as a kind of magnet, whether they really would, you know, whether we're talking about different groups of refugees and so on. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with everything David says here, but I think it is well worth reading, and he raises all the right issues, and it's again well worth your time. And then he ends the series with again a really good piece on what the government could be doing instead, and basically running a functioning asylum system would be a much more effective way of dealing with the refugee arrivals, and reminding us that the UK is not exceptional in some way, other than that actually we receive far fewer refugees than comparable states. The problem's actually much less in the United Kingdom than it is in many other global North countries and European countries as well. So it's just, I'm really pleased that we're able to publish that. It's a really good series, and I highly recommend it to you. Now, Sonia, I think, I don't know if you want to say anything about that series or just move straight on to the next item, which is also on the illegal migration bill, but by a different author.
I just wanted to say, I found in the Safe Routes article, I found it very interesting that he mentioned that Spain has created some sort of procedure where people can apply for refugee visas, it seems. So I'm going to go away and do more reading around that, because that sounds very interesting, because I can't really see how it would work. And then in the fourth article, if the illegal migration bill is unworkable, what can the government do instead? I took issue with a tiny little bit of this, which was where he said the government rightly challenges critics of the bill to provide alternative solutions. Every time the government says that, I just think that is essentially gaslighting, because they have been told repeatedly, they know perfectly well what the alternatives are. The problem is that the alternatives are humane, and that is not what they are intending to do with the illegal migration bill. They know that they need to process claims. It's easy to do so with high grant countries quickly. They should be letting people work. That would reduce the need for asylum support. They need to provide access to lawyers. I mean, you know, they know this stuff, and it is gaslighting for them to say that we need to come up with alternative solutions because we've done it and they're just ignoring us.
Yeah, absolutely. And David does go through those possibilities as well, doesn't he? And he's, you know, his line yes. is very much just get on with it, really.
Exactly. And the article, Two Ways to Address the Asylum Backlog and Improve Access to Justice, makes the same points. The productivity of Home Office asylum decision makers needs to be improved. Simplify and prioritize procedures and asylum processing for high grant countries. I can't remember if I've said this before, but one thing I think is going to be very interesting with this streamlining process is to see what proportion of people who receive that questionnaire and have returned it are then still being interviewed. I think that's really going to be quite determinative of the effectiveness of this streamlining process. And then the point is made that the illegal migration bill will only artificially reduce the backlog because people will still physically be here. They will just be excluded from the system. Then the other article I was going to cover is on the amendments to the illegal migration bill, which were made at quite a late stage. So the article is called Amendments to the Illegal Migration Bill Attack Basic Legal Rights and Processes. I think it was something like 70 pages or something. Like, a lot of government amendments came in at the last minute. So I found this article extremely useful.
Yeah, there were like 130 government amendments to their own legislation or something. It just sort of shows how badly thought through the whole thing is.
Yeah, and also, you know, again, there are the issues with the lack of scrutiny. So this article, hugely useful to anyone working on the bill. It's also hugely depressing. So that was Shona York who did this one. So these were amendments that were made by the government just prior to report stage, and she picks out five with the most potential to cause harm. That includes the definition of serious harm, which explicitly excludes claims based on inadequate healthcare in the receiving country. And presumably that is on the basis that healthcare in Rwanda is not very good. There is also a new clause limiting appeal rights against age assessments, and another one saying that refusal to consent to scientific methods for age assessment will lead to the person being treated as an adult. And then there is another clause stating that only a minister can make a decision to obey a Rule 39 order from the European Court of Human Rights. And if no decision on that has been made, then immigration officers and tribunal judges may not have regard to that order. And then there is a new clause 22, which directly abolishes all interim remedies preventing removal. And yes, that is all a horror show, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's grim. I think there was at least one, I think, vaguely positive change the government itself was making. You know, having forced everybody to vote for a measure that denies citizenship to the children of anybody to whom the bill applies, anybody who meets the criteria, I think they've now taken that out because it was just obviously going to make some kids stateless. You know, depending on your nationality, if your children are born abroad, you don't necessarily inherit the nationality of the parents. You know, there are some countries that have that rule in place, like India, for example, and therefore the kids would end up being stateless potentially. So I think that did come out, but you know, that is such a tiny change. You know, the sort of substance of it all remains in place. Yeah, it's pretty depressing. And the latest talk is that you know, the Lords might actually block it sort of formally and gut it so that it's no longer effective, so that it just doesn't work in the way the government intends, in which case the government might go to the Parliament Act, which is a sort of it forces it through the House of Lords, but there's a delay. The delay has to be at least a year, and you'd be looking at nothing happening basically until around the time of the next election, so it not being in place by the time of the next election. So yeah, and obviously we'll keep readers updated on what's going on and what the latest is.
So committee stage it's in the House of Lords, second reading next week, I think, and then committee stage shortly after that. I think that's where we're up to. And for anyone who is unaware, I would draw your attention to a briefing that's been prepared by the sector for the House of Lords on the illegal migration bill. And that can be found on Flex's website. That's Focus on Labour Exploitation. It's a huge, huge briefing, huge amount of work has gone into it. And it is extremely comprehensive and really the definitive read for this next stage of the bill.
Excellent. And have they published that impact assessment yet? As far as I know, they haven't. No, still, even now, they're still in due course. It will be published. In due allegedly. Course. Right. Okay. Well, let's move on. So I think we were going to cover next the suggestion that I've made for a new British Citizenship Act, which is something I've been thinking about for ages. I remember suggesting this to CJ, like, I think it was a couple of years ago, that I might write something about this and therefore make myself potentially quite unpopular, because I think this kind of proposal has its drawbacks, frankly, as well as its kind of advantages. So I published this on the, what was the date we put it out? 17th of April in the end. And it's what I've tried to do is set out some of the problems that I think we have with nationality law as it stands today, and then suggest some legislative solutions to those problems. Because I'm actually a bit of a skeptic these days about changing the law to achieve stuff, because a lot of what goes on in immigration law is really about resources and how you allocate resources, not necessarily about the law as such. But there are certain nationality issues which are basically legal in nature and therefore require new laws to change them. And I think there's plenty for different people to disagree with in this, but I'd hope that a lot of people would recognize the problems and also recognize that, you know, the law needs to be changed, and also therefore that you have to get politicians to do that, and to get politicians to commit to changing the law in some way, you know, unless it's piecemeal amendments, as we've seen, you know, since about 2002, I suppose, since sort of a lot of piecemeal amendments to British nationality law, to get serious changes, you need new legislation, you need a proper review, and you need to make it attractive to the politicians somehow. So I've included some stuff in there that I'm, you know, not particularly attached to personally, like, you know, looking at the obligations of citizenship or the idea of kind of reform of treason law or something like that, but as a way to get on the agenda issues like acquisition by children, the possibility of restoring birthright citizenship, or at least making it much more accessible to children born in the UK. There are other ways you could achieve that that would be less comprehensive but would still help people in a serious way. Perhaps talking about attaching rights to citizenship. Because one of my kind of little pet subjects is that there are no rights that are exclusive to British citizenship. And this kind of ties in with a constitutional reform paper that Gordon Brown put together sort of a couple of months ago. So again, if you're trying to attract interest from an incoming Labour government, this is the sort of mechanism you might use. So there's a few suggestions there. It's a relatively short piece. It's not a sort of fully thought through set of, you know, concrete legislative proposals as such. It's more kind of to try and get some attention for the issue and get people thinking about, you know, how we might go about addressing those issues. So Sonia, I put you on the spot. Like, what did you think? If you disagreed with stuff, do say so.
Oh, you know me. I'm always going to speak up if I disagree with something. My favorite bit in this was the bit about restoring the old statutory right for British citizens to be joined by family members. Mm. And I particularly liked the point about it encouraging people who are settled here to fully integrate as equal citizens. So I like that because, you know, it's a benefit and it is encouraging people to naturalize. So, you know, that seems like a really good, practical, humane proposal. So I really like that. The one that I did not like, and it makes me very nervous, is to connect human rights to British citizenship. I don't like the idea of there being any sort of two-tier situation when it comes to human rights specifically. So that I would need to see more detail about, basically. But overall, it absolutely needs to be overhauled. As I was saying to you beforehand, I realized quite recently, I'm British by descent, as is my partner. And if we had a child outside the UK, which is actually a possibility for us, then that child would not be a British citizen. And, you know, these are things that if you don't know, how on earth would you find out? Like, that's not in my passport. And why would people necessarily think about this if you're just sort of jollying about and then you have a child? You're not necessarily, you know, thinking, well, hang on a minute, how am I a British citizen? What do I need to do? You know, it's just a level of detail that I think is beyond most people. And so I think things like that really should be simplified and made a lot more straightforward. So yeah, I completely agree about the case for change. I guess it's just the detail that I'm not entirely sure about everything in the article.
Yeah. And I'm not entirely sure about it either. One of the challenges, I think, this was something that was in the, there was a quite an interesting thought-provoking review of British citizenship back in 2008, the Goldsmith Review, which I thought was very good. And then was kind of pretty much completely ignored in the citizenship proposals that the Labour government put forward the next year and actually passed into law, but were never implemented as earned citizenship nonsense. But the one of the points that Goldsmith made was that people should be encouraged to be citizens, and I think I agree with that. But the trick is not with a stick. So it's by, you know, you don't want to make ILR worse and therefore sort of encourage people to citizenship using kind of punishment effectively. You want to make it more attractive and remove the barriers, I think. So it is the trick is trying to find ways to do that. And kind of adding rights to citizenship and family reunion, giving preferential or improving family reunion rights specifically for citizens, but not downgrading them for existing permanent residents, I think would be one way of doing that. All right, well, let's move on. Do have a look at that proposal, and I'm interested in feedback, I'm interested in suggestions, I don't know. It's one of those things to kind of keep an eye on, and we'll be trying to sort of come up with some other ideas for how to do things a bit better over the next sort of over the next year or so. So watch this space. Now, Sonia, I think you were going to cover the next item, which was on bank account closures.
Yes. So Home Office resumes bank account closures. We're back into bad news land. So the Immigration Act 2014 requires banks to carry out immigration checks on all customers with a current account. And then if the bank discovers the person has no immigration status, they must report it to the Home Office. The Home Office can then require the bank to close the account. So these provisions originally came into force on 30th of October 2017. Then Windrush happened and was in the news, and so use of the power was suspended. And then on the 6th of April this year, the Home Office has started data sharing with the financial sector again, and that was foreshadowed in a speech by the Prime Minister in December last year. There are certain safeguards put in place, but Ian dismantles those quite easily with examples as to how they are inadequate. There are particular complexities for EU citizens and their family members, so I suspect that is where we will start seeing news stories first. And then finally, the point is that we know the Home Office data is inaccurate. The Independent Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration has said as much in their annual report published in March 2023 that states poor recording and use of data is another long-standing theme in ICIBI inspections.
Yeah, and exactly like he says, you see it in report after report. And this is one of those things where, you know, with Windrush, the Home Office claimed, oh, well, nobody could have anticipated this or whatever. We weren't warned. We're warning them now. This is going to be a bloody disaster for some people. And it's going to be people who aren't the ones the Home Office intends to affect. The examples that Ian sets out are all useful ones, I think, where, you know, people who are considered you know, I hate this kind of dichotomy between good migrants, bad migrants, and so on. But that's how a lot of people think. It's how the media present things. It's how politicians think, and so on. And it's going to be people who are considered to be the good migrants. You know, people who've made an innocent mistake, or people who had no idea that they were going to be in trouble. Who thought they were citizens but aren't, and so on. Who get affected by this? And having your bank account closed on you is such a disaster. It's so life-changingly awful. You know, I don't think the bank summons you and gives you the money in cash. You know, I think you just lose whatever's in there. And I'm not sure about that actually. Ought to be careful.
That seems unlawful.
Well, I don't know. Certainly, there was a confiscation power in the original legislation. I don't know what happens to the money, actually. But we have to maybe look into that and come back to people on it. But the you suddenly, if you've got rent payments to make, mortgage payments to make, they cut. You know, you've got no money. You've got no account that your pay can go into. You've got no way of making those payments. It is just life-changingly awful. And it's going to happen to people. The fact they've got this kind of human check, do we trust the Home Office to do that in a really robust, thorough way? Of course we don't. So this is just asking for really serious trouble. So watch this space. Right, Sonia, it's on to the case law. You're leading on the first few of these.
Okay, so the first one is High Court rejects challenge by Afghan families to hotel move. The case is HZ and Secretary of State for the Home Department, and it was in the admin court. So this was a challenge to decision to move families from one hotel, which was in Southwark, to another hotel in Manchester. That would lead to some families losing employment, and it would also cause a break in the children's education. The judge held that the decision was lawful, saying that the defendant had to, or was at least entitled to, consider a broad range of considerations, including migration pressure and cost factors, the prospects of scheme beneficiaries finding affordable permanent accommodation in due course in different areas, and the availability of education, work, health, and other services. Education was thus one of a range of factors, albeit an important one. The judge also concluded that Section 55 of the Borders, Citizenship and Immigration Act 2009, the best interest duty for the provision of safeguards and welfare of children, has no application in this context because the provision of bridging accommodation to families is not a function relating to immigration. And that seems to be because they were granted ILR, which is, of course, what the Home Office did for people who were evacuated out of Afghanistan. So overall, that is a disappointing result, and it will leave Afghan families who came to the UK under the resettlement schemes vulnerable to repeated moves between hotels while they are also trying to establish themselves in the UK. The next case is, the article is High Court dismisses challenge to family reunion rules for refugee children. The case is DM and Secretary of State for the Home Department. It's also in the admin court. DM is an Eritrean national who left Eritrea when he was 11 years old in March 2014. He arrived in the UK in May 2017, over 3 years later, when he was 14. He was granted refugee status in November 2018, just after he turned 16. He didn't know about family reunion initially, and, you know, that really undermines, I think, the government saying that children are used to bring families over. It was almost 2 years later when his parents and siblings applied in September 2020. That was refused in June 2021. The appeal was successful and they were granted leave in line, so that was good news. But before that grant, DM had lodged a judicial review application challenging the refusal to grant entry clearance, and that included a broader challenge to the exclusion in the immigration rules of refugee children from family reunion. UNHCR intervened in this case, which is an indication of how important the issue is, which is refugee children being able to bring their family to be with them. However, the case was unsuccessful on two grounds, and a decision on the third ground was adjourned. And that is related to the argument that the SSHD cannot circumvent her duty to act in the best interests of children under Section 55 by failing to amend the immigration rules to provide a route to family reunion for child refugees. So that one may still resurface later. I just wanted to briefly mention another family reunion case, which the article is Upper Tribunal Awards Significant Damages for Unlawful Dublin Refusal. So £10,500 was awarded to a child who was unlawfully prevented from entering the UK from Greece to be reunited with his cousin, who had been recognised as a refugee and had lived in the UK for many years. The case is MA and Secretary of State for the Home Department. It is unreported, but it is available on the Doughty Street website. I just thought it was a bit of, you know, a little bit of good news after that previous depressing case. You know, to what extent money can ever compensate for what these kids go through, and to be separated from your family like that, you know, it's obviously not the same, but that is still an excellent result for that child.
Yeah, and money's useful when it comes down to it. Money's useful.
Well, yes.
It might not be proper compensation, but it's still useful. Yeah. Okay, well, I've got a couple of cases to cover. I don't want to spend too long on. One of them is on judicial review and the ouster clause, which is quite a big subject. It's got a lovely name as well. Oceana against Upper Tribunal, 2023 EWHC 791 admin. And it's to do with the new ouster clause for CART's judicial reviews. Now, these are a pretty esoteric, unusual mechanism. It's where basically you can't get permission to appeal from the tribunal, and you try to get it from the High Court instead, essentially. And they were already hard to do, and they've been made harder following reforms in 2022. And essentially you've got to now show that the Upper Tribunal has acted in bad faith or in such a procedurally defective way as amounts to a fundamental breach of the principles of natural justice. So just the fact that the tribunal screwed up, the fact that they made an error of law or a really serious error of fact doesn't matter, and that will be allowed to stand. It's only where you've got one of these kind of bad faith or serious natural justice issues that the High Court will intervene and grant permission. And so one of the issues before the tribunal in this case was whether the ouster clause was effective. And in I think a passage that some legal academics have objected to, Mr. Justice Saini basically sets to one side. I think I'm paraphrasing there, but so that's the essential phrase that he uses. He puts aside the academic commentary on this. So academic commentators were a bit upset about that, and basically holds that, you know, Parliament has changed the law, and it's the court's job to apply that. So the facts of the case don't matter that much. It's you know, for other people, it's obviously a bit very bad news for the woman concerned. But so far, you know, the ouster clause is good in legal terms as far as the courts are concerned. Whether that's going any further, I don't know. I haven't heard anything. May not necessarily be the last word, but I have to say I'd be pretty surprised if that result gets overturned. It's, you know, I'd be very surprised if the courts make a big fuss about the nature of CART review, as long as it's still there to some degree. I think the courts probably let that go. Sonia, no need to say anything, but have you got anything you wanted to say on that one?
Nope, nothing to add.
Okay, I shall move straight on to the next one then, which is another bit of bad news and a bit, I don't really understand this case, I don't think. Possibly because I've only skimmed through it rather than sort of spending a long time going over it. But this is about the domestic violence rules, where you come to the UK, you've got lawful stay, you are a victim of domestic violence, and you're a dependent on somebody, and it gives you, the domestic violence rules give you a route to achieving settlement in the UK independently of the kind of, you know, your original sponsor, basically. But it only exists for certain routes and not for others. And I just don't really understand the rationale of why it doesn't exist for all routes. So where you've got somebody who is the partner of a settled person or a British citizen, or where you've got somebody who's the partner of a person with refugee status or an EEA national, then this route is available to them, but it's not available to you if you are the partner of somebody who's a skilled worker, basically. And this particular case, just give you the name quickly, it's RSWP against Secretary of State for the Home Department, 2022 EWHC 2067 admin. And this was actually tier two visa, but you know, these days it's skilled migrants, a skilled worker. And the fact is that that does generally lead to settlement. And I'd be interested to see the statistics on how many tier two or skilled worker migrants go on to then achieve settlement compared to partners of settled migrants or people who are settled in the UK, because I suspect that the stats aren't that different. And I know there's a dropout rate, a surprisingly high dropout rate for spouses and partners generally, and they probably stay in the UK, a lot of them. They just don't realise that they don't have status, or some of them might leave. And then compare that against the skilled work ones. I suspect there's not that much difference. And so the sort of rationale then for having a different treatment, I think falls away to a significant extent. So that's unfortunately pretty bad news. I don't know, again, if that one's going to go any further. Sonia, you were going to talk about a case on exceptional circumstances in spouse or partner applications.
Not actually a case. It's just a very useful article that just explains how you use exceptional circumstances in a spouse or partner visa application under Appendix FM. I am working on an application on this basis at the moment, and I've already gone and read this like three times. I think it's really clear, well-written, very useful. So it sets out how exceptional circumstances doesn't exempt you from all of the rules. That's mainly suitability. It sets out paragraphs Gen 3.3 to 3.3, which is relevant for applications for leave to enter or remain, and paragraph EX1, which is applications for leave to remain only. And then if you're granted, you go into the 10-year route, and it explains that you can actually, once you meet the requirements, you can then apply earlier than when your leave expires and switch into the 5-year route once you meet the requirements. So for example, if you don't meet the immigration status requirement, you rely on exceptional circumstances, you were then granted in the 10-year route, you then have leave and you meet the immigration status requirements, you could apply straight away and go into the 5-year route if you want to spend the money. And then neither category of applicant will have recourse to public funds automatically. The Home Office should consider whether or not it's appropriate to apply the no recourse to public funds restriction. If they do apply it, it is possible to get that lifted in certain circumstances. And there's a link to the recourse to public funds article.
Okay, thanks, Sonia. And let's give a shout out to, it's Gabriella Batiga, I think, who wrote that one for us.
So
well done. That does sound genuinely very helpful.
And now we're on to the work visa section.
Yes.
And the first article I'm covering is how to apply for a senior or specialist worker visa. This is the Global Business Mobility Senior or Specialist Worker Visa, was previously known as the Intra-Company Transfer Visa. I sort of feel like that is an easier name, Intra-Company Transfer Visa. It really is clear as to what it does, but there you go. Last year, the route was rebranded, and it is in the immigration rules under Appendix Global Business Mobility. The visa allows multinational companies to send skilled employees to work for a linked business in the UK doing graduate level employment or training. Dependent family members can also come. It does not lead to settlement. And the best thing about using this visa is that there is no proof of English language ability required. So if you feel like, you know, you might have a client who that visa would be useful for, then I would recommend that you go and have a look at this article, which sets out all of the different requirements for sponsors and for applicants.
Yeah, that, again, sounds very helpful. And a shout out to Pip Hague, who wrote that one. But you're right, I think it does fail the RONSEAL test, doesn't it? Yeah. It's like, I don't know what that visa is about, whereas I did know about what, you know, an intercompany transfer was.
Exactly, you know, simplification. Mm. The next article is just a very quick flagging up to people, reporting hybrid working patterns, new sponsor obligations. So during the pandemic, the Home Office advised that there was no obligation for sponsors to notify if a sponsored worker was working from home, because obviously a lot of people were working from home. That exception has now been removed, and the Home Office has amended Part 3 of the sponsor guidance to require sponsors of overseas workers to report their sponsored workers' usual working locations. The new guidance sets out a reporting requirement where a worker has moved or will be moving to a hybrid working pattern as a more permanent working arrangement, but short changes to work patterns do not need to be reported.
Great. Thank you very much. And then it falls to me to try and come up with the good news story to end on. And happily, we did have a good news story that was published in April. So with the title, Visit Visa Operations Are Refreshingly Well Run. So this is an independent chief inspector of borders and immigration report. And it sounds like he was pretty impressed with this one, basically. But I did note, couldn't help saying, I hope I will find similar good practice in the imminent inspection of asylum casework. Not likely, by the sounds of things, from all the reporting we've seen of what sort of staff turnover and disaster area asylum casework is. But no, that doesn't detract from the fact that it is possible for the Home Office to actually do a decent job in processing applications and actually managing its staff in a way that keeps people happy. He says the caseworkers I spoke to are a particularly cohesive group, well-led, well-managed, benefiting significantly from working collaboratively together in a shared workspace. It's good, legit good news story for efficient visa operations.
No, I'm just waiting with bated breath to see the report on asylum caseworking.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. That is going to be interesting. I don't think that's going to be our good news story in the appropriate month that it comes out, is it?
No, probably not.
Right. Okay. So on that note, let's end. We hope that was helpful. We've covered April 2023, and we'll be back next month with May's update. Goodbye.